look. Oh, listen, I suppose. The music. Man, I should have taken a bathroom break before I came in. Sorry. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Ryssdal.
And I'm Molly Wood, focused as ever.
Well, look, I've been sick, and they always tell you to hydrate, so that's what I'm doing.
Oh,
you know.
I see.
So, speaking of being sick still, I was out last week for two reasons. One is I was sick, and the other one is I was traveling, and I completely let my calendar get away from me, and I left Ms. Wood all by her lonesome, and that was lame, and I apologize.
Oh, that's so nice of you, because I did the exact same thing to you, so I think we're good.
We're now officially even. There you go.
We're even, Steven.
Yes.
Nobody's mad. Yeah.
So wait, where are we? Oh, yes.
Feeling better-ish?
Ish. I sound a little weird, but whatever. I'll just have to get over that. This is, of course, Make Me Smart, our little podcast that we do. It's all y'all and us, and it's science. No, it's not. It's technology, the economy, and culture. None of us is as smart as all of us. Come on, I've been sick. Leave me alone.
I mean, it could be science. Let's throw some of that in there.
Tech is science.
Why not? Okay, I think we can agree that we are excited about today's show because sometimes the news peg rises up and just...
It's just too perfect.
It's too good. Yep. This is one of those like confluences of magical events. We had planned to do a show where we were going to talk about venture capital and how it intersects with Wall Street and private valuations. And then because on the heels, of course, of the ongoing banana pants disaster that has been WeWork and its IPO. And here we are with that show planned for today.
Yeah. It was perspicacity, let me just tell you. We saw it coming and we said we got to do it. Anyway, so we're going to talk about a derivative of that, which is venture capital versus the stock market, why you pick one or the other if you're an entrepreneur, or when you go public and when you don't, and what happens and why, and all of that good stuff. And to help us get smart on this, we've got Erin Griffith on the phone. She's a New York Times reporter covering startups and venture capital. She's up in San Francisco. Erin, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, I guess, the nuts and bolts, right? And for those who maybe don't listen to Marketplace a lot or don't follow this stuff, the difference between venture capital money and money that a company gets when it goes public. Discuss.
Yeah. So, it's essentially public versus private. Venture capital firms raise money from private endowments, from pension funds, from any kind of investment sovereign wealth funds, and then they invest it privately into high-risk tech startups, primarily some biotech, et cetera. But the gist is that these are really, really risky, and the government doesn't want the average person putting money into high-risk companies like this. And so you have to be a accredited, sophisticated investor in order to put your money in private tech startups. The stock market is for anybody. These are companies that are highly regulated. They have to report all of their earnings and follow all of these SEC rules. They're considered, safer by the government, and so anybody can invest in them. And so essentially, when you start a company, it's risky. It might fail. A lot of companies fail. By the time you get to the public markets and list your shares for anybody to buy, the idea is that it's maybe a little bit de-risked.
Which gets us in a neat and tidy way to the subject du jour, Molly Wood, Ms. Banana Pants.
It sure does. So I like how you say sort of, there's in theory for a lot of these things, right? In theory, a company will get private money and grow to a certain point and then go public in order to continue to grow, which I think is a paradigm we've already seen change.
Yes, this is how it is designed, but in practice, it's different.
Exactly. And so in practice, if, then you get your money back by going public and have access to a larger pool of capital. When we look at Uber, Peloton, WeWork, Lyft, these companies that all tried to go public when they were already really huge, what happens then? How has this paradigm kind of changed?
Right. So in the last decade or so, last 15 years or so, it has the amount of time that companies take to go public has expanded for a couple different reasons. One reason is that they are able to just raise so much money in the private markets that they don't have to go public. There's so much interest in investing in high growth tech startups. That's where all the growth is. Interest rates have been really low for a while, and so investors are looking to sort of boost their returns by rushing into the private market. So they have so much capital available to them. And in addition to that, there is a lot of scrutiny that comes along with being public. Like I said, you have to report all these things to the SEC. There are analysts on your earnings calls every single quarter saying, like, how much are you going to grow? grow? Are you profitable? You know, you can be shorted. You can. There's a lot of stress that comes with being a public company, and so these startups are saying, "Hey, we've got all the money we want in the private market. We'll just stay private as long as we can." The problem with that is the longer you stay private, you don't have any pressure to actually turn a profit or, I don't know, be a real business or, you know, do some of these things that the SEC, like, really, really likes. You know, your accounting can be just kind of a little bit loose. And you can throw all this venture capital that you're raising all into the service of growing as big as possible. So that's kind of what we're seeing now is that, you know, a company like Uber can be worth $70 billion before they go even go public. And so that's fairly unprecedented. I mean, Facebook is kind of the only other example of a company that's in Alibaba, I guess, in the last decade that has gotten to that size before they go public.
Okay, so let's get to WeWork and nuts and bolts, right? Because I think we really need to put a stake into this thing and kill it off once and forever. This company was valued privately at $49 billion American dollars. And then yesterday we learned that SoftBank, one of its original funders, its loan money, its invested money, it's a giant conglomerate from Japan, is going to take control of this thing at a valuation of $8 billion. So how do we go from $49 billion privately to what is now reported as $8 billion, all because we finally got a look at the company's paperwork?
It is mind-boggling. I mean, I'm asking myself that question now. Right. I mean, what about the company has fundamentally changed in the last month?
Right.
I mean, they ousted their CEO. They're spinning off different, you know, things that they've acquired over the last few years. They're going to be laying off a bunch of staff. Like this is a total meltdown, and it raises a lot of questions about private market valuations. I mean, a lot of people are blaming this on SoftBank, which is they have this $100 billion vision fund, which is very unprecedented in private investing. And they are the ones that have poured the majority of the $10 billion in private funding that WeWork has raised over the last few years. And so they're the ones that are setting this valuation. So it's raising a lot of questions about, like, are private market valuations, do they even mean anything? I mean, it's just, unlike in a public market, which is truly liquid, which requires buyers and sellers to agree on stock prices, and that sort of, you know, sets the company's valuation, this is just kind of a small group of private investors, namely SoftBank, that's setting the valuation and deciding, sure, seems like a $49 billion company.
Right.
And, you know, perhaps those things aren't real. Those numbers aren't real.
Well, let's talk about how we get to those numbers, because that is kind of the crux here. It's sort of like, I guess in the old days, there used to be a formula, right? Which was like, you would sort of try to figure out how much a company was worth and how much would be on its balance sheet in 20 years. And then you would discount back, mm-hmm. you know, that assumption, and the valuation would be determined accordingly by some MBA level math. Is some version of that still happening, or is it literally just a fiction?
You know, I talk to venture capitalists about this a lot, and I think that is still happening for software companies. For companies that sell, their main business is selling software to other businesses. It's predictable revenue usually. There are models that they can use, and those companies are going public, and they're actually getting really high valuations because they're super attractive. They have very high margins, and they're able to become extremely profitable because once you make software once, you know, you can sell it a million times. It's a really attractive business. The problem is, in the last decade, with this whole idea of software eating the world, and, you know, every single company or every single industry is being disrupted, from real estate to education to transportation to hotels. You know, all of the biggest tech companies of this last generation are trying to disrupt existing industries, but those industries mm-hmm. don't necessarily translate to the same kind of, like, profits and gross margins that pure software companies can earn. And so I think that's been a little bit of a challenge. Private investors thought that companies like WeWork or Uber or Peloton could be valued in the same way as a pure software company, and that's where they get these crazy valuations. But public market investors are saying, yeah, I don't think so. WeWork is a real estate company. Uber is a transportation or gig economy company. Right. We don't even know how to value gig economy yet because we haven't seen whether or not they are even capable of turning a profit.
So do you think the days of gangbuster IPOs, I mean, this has been a tough year for IPOs, right? And you just rounded off a couple of companies. Mm-hmm. Do you think the days of IPOs where everybody at the company is a gazillionaire on day two of trading. Are those done for, or is this just a pause, as the Fed might say?
Well, you know, the early investors who got in when the companies were valued at, you know, less than $1 billion or more, you know, those investors are still making a lot of money. Some of the early employees are probably still going to make a lot of money. So there is some value here. And I actually think that it's important to distinguish Uber and WeWork and Lyft. And these companies are the ones that get all the headlines. But there are a lot of much smaller companies. And Zoom is the video software conferencing company that are actually doing great that went public this year. And they've seen their stock prices soar. And investors are really excited about them. The difference is they're pure software companies, like I mentioned. B, some of them are profitable, like Zoom. So there is a little bit of a split in the market. And so some companies that are going public sooner that maybe have a better, you know, business profile or maybe more profitable have more room to grow. Mm-hmm. You know, investors can see them doubling or tripling their stock price in the next few years. It's kind of hard to do that when you're already at $70 billion. So imagine, mm-hmm. could Uber be worth 140 or, you know. So, you know, I think there is a lot of opportunity still in tech, but the bigger companies are starting to realize, okay, maybe things got a little overinflated.
You know, it's funny because tech companies like to complain about going public markets. They're mm-hmm. trying to sort of launch their own boutique version of public markets in the long-term stock exchange. But wouldn't you say, actually, that when you look at Uber's returns or Lyft's returns or WeWork, where indeed, which, you know, I did speculate about, everybody sort of collectively said, like, nope, nobody's money should be exposed to that. It's too banana pants. And there was a de facto banana pants rule. Isn't that actually a case of the markets working?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the question is, like, who is actually really the victim here with WeWork? And I've been thinking about this a lot. And So some private market investors who are, you know, mostly SoftBank, but a few others that got in later are going to obviously lose a lot of money. There'll probably be some lawsuits about it, but it's hard to feel too bad for them. There are no, you know, mom and pop investors who got into this company, like in the dot-com bubble, which, you know, there were real victims, and that people lost a lot of their savings. You know, you could argue pension funds that are, you know, somehow invested through these venture capital funds might be losing out. But, you know, this is high risk. So yeah, it does make sense. The people who are, though, going to get hurt in this instance will be the employees who, you know, were being paid partly in stock, and they might have been issued stock that's now going to be deeply underwater. So that's very unfortunate. Obviously, the people who are going to lose their jobs are not going to have a great outcome either. So I think you're right in a way that this is actually heartening to see that public market investors are not as crazy as maybe some of the private market investors have been recently. And so maybe this will lead to a healthy reset.
Although I guess we should point out here, though, that the part that is not heartening is that Adam Neumann is probably still going to walk away with this, you know, from this thing with $1 billion.
That's the other part of this, right? The hijinks that Neumann was able to get away with by keeping this company private for so long, and then he files the S-1 and his world explodes because he's doing things like trademarking "we" and selling it back to himself, or selling it to the company at his own benefit, right? I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. That's just
and then he takes $300 million out along the way, and then now it looks like, you know, his total package is well over $1 billion that he's going to get, and that almost makes the $6 million, which was egregious, look like chump change. It's pretty surprising.
I guess that part is still not working. That part could still use a little fine-tuning.
Yeah, and this happened with Uber, too. You know, Travis Kalanick walked away with a lot of money. I mean, listen, they built the company from scratch. He started it. He got it to a certain point. Like, you gotta give him some credit for that. And, like, you could make the argument with WeWork in particular that they were doing okay and that the business itself does make sense and it could work. But once SoftBank got involved and started just, like, dumping truckloads of cash on, things spiraled out of control.
Mm-hmm. And then that raises a question about, again, venture capital versus public markets, where there is this visibility on some level. What is, you know, we saw Theranos, for example, and then all of the questions mm-hmm. and recriminations that came from that. Like, why weren't these private investors asking more questions? In the case mm-hmm. of WeWork, where was their board? You know, where were, how, what were private investors asking as this company grew? And so I wonder, do you think that we'll start to see more pressure or changes or some sort of rules around due diligence from these investors as these companies grow?
That's a good question.
Honestly, I don't want to be cynical. I want to think, I want to say,
come on,
yes,
come on, come over,
that,
to, come over to my, but, side of this podcast. Come on.
No, I know. I mean, that's the space I occupy. And so, because we've seen this happen before. We, you know, there was a big pullback in 2015 when the mutual funds were marking down their valuations of some of the biggest unicorns. And everyone was like, oh, here it comes. Get ready for winter. And we're going to be austere. We're going to try to save up money and raise more and cut our burn rates. And then SoftBank comes along with a $100 billion fund. And, you know, as long as this, like, endless supply of cash is available from sovereign wealth funds, from places like SoftBank, from all the big VC firms that then went and raised big late-stage funds just to compete with SoftBank, as long as that money is available, I just don't think the discipline is going to follow. If there is a big pullback and this whole thing kind of could start unraveling, people could get nervous, VC funds would maybe struggle to raise new outsized funds because all of the pension funds are, you know, lowering their allocations. If that all that whole thing starts to spiral, then yes, I could see a pullback. But until then, as long as the money is available, I just think there is an inherent lack of discipline that comes along with that.
Yep.
That's a lot of ifs. Aaron Griffith reports on technology startups and venture capital for the New York Times. Aaron, thanks so much for coming
on
the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So there you go. Let us know what you think about all of this stuff. I mean, send your banana pants thoughts on WeWork, of course, but also, you know, venture capital versus the stock market. You know, would you get in? If you had a chance to buy into WeWork 6 months ago, would you have?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a good question.
I mean, I did an event recently where I asked with Mike Isaac, who wrote about talked to him also,
his
super
Uber
pumped
book, yeah,
about Uber. And I said, listen, like Bill Gurley, the
VC
benchmark investor
board,
venture capitalist who really, you know, got in hard on Uber and then also sort of orchestrated this coup that got Kalanick out. You still ask, would he have done anything differently? Because he probably walked away from that deal with $1 billion.
Oh, man.
Yep.
God.
Yep.
Tough.
It's crazy. Also, I think that we all need to band together and ask Twitter why emojis can't be a hashtag. I tried to make a hashtag out of banana pants, the banana and the pants emoji, and it won't. It doesn't work.
You learn something new every day on this podcast.
We've uncovered a bug.
Make Me Smart brought to life right there. Send us a voice memo about your emoji preferences, about this, about whatever you like. Make Me Smart at marketplace.org. We'll be right back. An extra couple of beats there. We're back. Time for us, and I will just read from the rundown under the thing that says Molly Wood, where she inserts her items. She says, and this is a quote, I know. You know why she said that, people? Because she has three items. Three.
One of them is the same. Two of them are just two links about the same thing.
Uh-huh. Okay. Go
ahead.
And
it's just, all it is a more specific update on WeWork, because I really cannot let go of the fact that as part of the SoftBank buyout deal, they will likely buy nearly $1 billion of stock from Adam Neumann directly.
Yep.
And extend him roughly $500 million in credit to help him repay a loan, $700 million loan that they gave him, and will also pay him a $185 million consulting fee. This is a company who is now in a position, the position of saying, we may have enough cash to make it until Thanksgiving, but probably not Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah.
That there, you know, that there's like massive, I don't know. And you wonder why, like we talk about this a lot on the show about why people get so mad, because it feels like this whole thing is just a big shell game. And frankly, that is a complaint about venture capital too, that it's like just moving money around to the same people.
Well, and then yep. Sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Finish your thought and then I'll add an addendum.
Well, yeah. And then it's sort of like the people who are dumb enough to go work there. And I mean that my dumb enough is in quotes, right? Like you're the ones who nobody's taking care of.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, all these employees who, as Aaron said, were going to be millionaires a month ago and now, you know, are going to lose their jobs. So people fed up with high tech and venture capital and people getting rich and not looking out for the little guy. There's a politics parallel to that, actually, too, about people getting fed up with the government and not looking out for the little guy and all of that stuff. And I just
just
kind of came to me.
All right, it's all like part and parcel of the same feeling that everybody has, which is sort of like, how come all of them are winning?
Right.
And we're still not. Still not.
Oh, man, that's 2 weeks in a row that I've been here that you've gotten the sense.
Wah,
that,
wah.
The dark place.
Well, and then meanwhile, my second thing is actually slightly related, but maybe different,
as our
listeners like to say.
Yes.
Which is that we are also at a point where our governments can't even take care of our social services. And so now Facebook is saying that it's going to give $1 billion in a package of grants, loans, and land toward easing California's housing crunch and building 20,000 new housing units for middle and lower income households. Google has done the same, also pledged $1 billion. Microsoft has pledged $500 million. I don't even want to be cynical about this, except that like the money is not necessarily the problem when it comes to California's housing crisis. It's actually the part where we won't build.
Right. Availability. Certainly San Francisco for sure, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a regulation thing. Like, we literally won't build these houses. But yes, like, now we're to the point where we're going to have to go and sort of grovel to these companies that, like, caused these housing crises in some way.
Yep.
And ask them for money to fix it. I don't know.
Because they have the money.
It's like a weird world because they have the money and we do not.
That's right. That's right. So don't get me started on taxes and what people want from their government. Okay. So that's you. You good?
I'm exhausted. Your turn.
All right. Here's me. Mine is a good deal lighter, and it goes like this. I was having a conversation with my son about 6 months ago. He's 21. He's a senior in college. And, you know, our primary means of communication these days is texting, right? Because he's in Washington, D.C., and I'm here. And, you know, we talk every weekend, but during the week we text. And at some point it comes up in a conversation about my texting style. And he says, Dad, you put like punctuation on the end of your text. It sounds so harsh. And I said in the most loving and kind parental way possible, shut up. That's ridiculous. Get over it. That's just how I write. Okay. I also, and you'll see why this is relevant, I also use a lot of ellipses, okay, in my texts and in my writing for the radio. So that's 6 months ago. Yesterday on Marketplace, Megan McCarty Carino, who has been on this podcast, our workplace culture reporter, did a story on generational miscommunication in the workplace, right? That there are older workers and younger workers in the same workplace with new means of communication, and it's leading to all kinds of problems. And the lead anecdote was a guy who had just finished a big project, and he sent it up the chain, and here's what happened.
They use periods a lot, which I didn't even realize this, but they sound very stern, like very final.
Or even worse,
they'll do this thing where they end their emails or their instant messages or texts with an ellipsis, so dot, 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 which for a millennial is just like the height of passive aggression.
So let me just right here and right now say it and get it out of the way. Hey, you kids, get off of my lawn. That's it. That's where I am.
You know, I happen to say you also do this other thing.
What?
That is classic, like a classic delineation of texting age, is the 1K.
Oh, yeah.
Just the 1K.
Yeah.
And I had to have this conversation actually with a good friend of mine who said, why do people use like KK? And I'm like, because K means I hate you.
Really?
1K. Yeah. It is literally.
This is really funny because I'm looking at our Slack that we just exchanged in the middle of that interview with Eric Griffith. And I said, K, you say bye. K. And you responded, KK.
I know, because you also did K period, which I can only assume means you're sitting there just in a blind rage at me right now. Like,
oh my God.
That his face is all red and he's just like, I cannot with this woman. Yeah. And then I saw this thing on Instagram the other day that was like, boomers out here using single K, not even knowing the damage that they're doing.
Oh my God. It's really funny. It's really funny.
Yeah. Anyway, and honestly, it should be taught. I love that Megan did the story because it should be taught at work.
So I sent it to my son yesterday and he was like, ha! Told you.
Amazing.
So there you
go.
I have learned my lesson.
All right. Let's hear. I know that we're going to get feedback about this
for next
week, and I am excited. Make me smart at marketplace.org. In the meantime, let's hear what you had to say before.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Okay.
So last week was all about sustainable fashion. I remain obsessed with that episode. It was so interesting. Yeah. And we got a ton of comments. A lot of them were from women. I'm not going to assume that that's because we were talking about clothes, but because we have been asking you constantly for more women contributors to the show. You're heeding the call. Here is listener Kristen McCoy.
My name is Kristen, and I'm an eco-friendly clothing designer and a professional tailor. I know this idea of moving towards a more sustainable wardrobe can be daunting, and it's difficult to know where to start. There's also this instinct that we need to clean out the closet, get rid of everything, and start fresh with a more sustainable wardrobe. But when you think about that, if we're getting rid of all the stuff in the closet, that is actually wasteful in itself and adding to the piles in the landfills. Sometimes the most sustainable thing you can do is just work with what you have and shop your own closet. And everybody has garments in their closet that they can't let go of for one reason or another, but they also can't wear. And you can bring those to a local tailor, get them upcycled, get them altered, just updated a little bit, maybe mended, and get those ones back into the rotation in your wardrobe instead of going out to buy brand new again. And then after you clean up your closet, instead of cleaning out your closet, then you can move forward by adopting more sustainable shopping habits when it comes to buying new clothing.
Yes.
So this partly started because last week I said, oh, I'm going to go clean out my closet. Or I think I was more saying I'm going to Instagram all of my like shame.
Oh, jeez.
Show you all the unfortunate fast food. But and several people wrote back and said that that's like a bad idea. I want to make it clear. I have never thrown away an item of clothing.
Don't do that.
That is what I found astonishing is that all these people were like, oh, you're going to throw your clothes away. And I'm like, oh, this is Northern California. The cops would come.
Oh, jeez.
It's a pretty fussy place.
All right. Same
anyway,
topic.
Anyway, I love the idea that there's a sustainable tailor, though.
Yes.
That's pretty great.
Same topic, different person. Dave Meyer, here you go.
Hi, Molly and Kai. Thanks for your recent episode on the climate impacts of fashion. I think this is an important topic and one that we don't think about enough, so I appreciate you taking the time to dive in. I would, however, like to point out a couple of inconsistencies raised by your guest. First, she complains about the income inequality inherent in the fashion industry and then advocates for purchasing organic, naturally dyed cotton, which is something that's really only available to people with significant means. Second, she throws shade at GMOs in general and GMO cotton in particular, but then advocates for a company that is using GMO yeast to grow silk as a silk replacement. I think this just shows that GMOs are not a blanket bad, as some people like to paint them, and it takes a more nuanced discussion. Anyway, thanks again for the episode, and keep up the good work.
So, yes, it's easier to be sustainable when you have means. That is absolutely true. And yes, GMOs are, you know, subject to interpretation. Yeah, for sure.
Which I think we got a lot. We got a surprising number of emails and tweets. There was a tweet from somebody saying, I stopped listening as soon as she said GMOs are bad. I am pretty sure that what she said is that they're controversial and a lot of people think they're bad. But I do take the point that it might be worth an episode? Is that just too terrifying? I mean, I think it is a really, really complicated question.
Yeah.
And people have really strong feelings. And I think that some of those strong feelings sometimes come from a place of misunderstanding. And maybe it's that either makes it a great make me smart topic or a horrible one because no one wants to listen.
Let us table that one in the British parliamentary sense, which is to say, let's put it out there for further discussion. How about that?
Yeah. Yep. All exactly. Right. Let us know what you think and whether we should take on that topic.
Yep.
Because clearly there are feelings.
Yes. Yes, yes. All right.
It is time for the Make Me Smart question. And apparently this week, it's me.
Yeah, I don't know. This one's a little weird. We got an email from a guy named Jose Gomez, and he told us he wanted to see how easy it was or is for a layperson to create a deep fake from scratch. Remember the episode we did a number of months ago. Jose has a master's in software engineering, so he's got some chops, but he says he has no experience with doing actual deep fakes.
But he found a GitHub repository for real-time voice cloning, and he plugged in some audio from an old episode of Make Me Smart. He said, after about 2 hours of fiddling, quote, I was able to use a sample from Molly and generate an answer to the Make Me Smart question using Molly's deep fake voice.
Wow.
Oh, God, I'm terrified.
We will all hear it here for the first time.
Something I thought I knew and later found out I was wrong about is the following. I didn't think that in my lifetime someone with an average computer and an average pew would be able to sample just 5 seconds of someone's voice and generate a pretty decent clone of that person's voice. Yet here we are. I was able to take about 40 seconds of Molly's voice from a podcast earlier this month, pass it through a neural network, and generate this audio. It certainly isn't perfect, but it is far from terrible. And with a little bit more work, I think I could fool some people.
Wow. I mean, I hear a little bit of you in there.
Yeah, I mean, luckily for me, it's like pretty scratchy and stuff. But
yeah, had it been played cold, I don't know if I'd have said it was you. But I could hear you.
Yeah. Well, like you said, with a little bit more work, probably right. A little bit more work in a sound engineer. Great. Also, I think the deep fake episode is the one I left you hanging on, and you had to do that one all by yourself.
Oh,
weird callback.
And it turns out you were in there anyway. So you know,
great. Good job, Jose.
All right. Yes. Send us voice memos about anything you heard on this podcast. We will listen to them and put some of them on the pod next week or in weeks to come. It's makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, newsletter call out. We'll put a link to last week's issue in the show notes, but also just go to marketplace.org/newsletters and subscribe so you don't miss one.
Make Me Smart was produced and directed this week by Sam Anderson. The new guy's still doing great. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner.
No pressure.
At some point, he'll not be the new guy anymore. Doing great. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Also doing great. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore.
Daniel Ramirez engineered this week's program, also co-wrote with one Ben Tolliday the theme song that you're listening to. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And there we go.
I think I jumped the gun. I started early. We got a lot of dancing time left.
There is no dancing on this podcast. Did you not get the memo?
I'm dancing. And it's on video.
It is on video. Now I'm going to have to go watch.
You can see my rainbow scrunchie and everything.
Wow. All right.
Great. I'll upload all this and...
All right, bye.
I don't know where that comes from. Okay, bye.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.